Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Incomparable, number 619, June 2022.
Welcome back to The Incomparable. I'm Glenn Fleischman. While Jason Snell is conducting the annual staff review in the rear of the Zeppelin, I've taken the helm to talk about cartoons. Specifically, we're talking about grown-up cartoons. That is, animation designed with an adult sensibility, as opposed to, say, adult cartoons, which often means something entirely different. We're going to talk about this overall trend, some recent series, older faves, and probably a lot more. Joining me on this episode are Moises Chouyan.
Does this mean we can curse?
I don't know. I have to ask the editor. David Lohr.
Fire. Fire. Fire.
I wasn't expecting that. John McCoy.
I have nothing funny to say.
I know. We put you on the spot. This is the trial by fire. Lisa Schmeiser. Hello. Fire.
It's a sick, sad world.
Yes. Tony Sindelar. Hello, nerd.
Cowabunga, nerds?
Cowabunga. Cowabunga, indeed. Well, this show has been much on my mind because during pandemic, a lot of animation got released. Maybe because it was easier to produce animation during pandemic. I don't know, but probably. But a lot of new series came out, and some of them were exceptionally violent, and some had overt or graphic sex in them, which was surprising when I was watching The Legend of Vox Machina with my 15-year-old, and I was like, oh, okay, all right, well, I guess we, you know, we'll have some more discussions. But so I was thinking of Invincible, which we did a Mothership episode about, Hit Monkey, and I said Legend of Vox Machina, you know, you go back not very far, we've got Harley Quinn. I think the last episodes are a couple years ago on HBO, Tuca and Birdie. Maybe Archer was kind of a prototype, and the Venture Brothers. So I've stuck a sort of rubric on this to give focus, but I would ask everybody, and in your own ways or in any kind of free-for-all you want to talk about, how would you define what like a more kind of grown-up cartoon is as opposed to an all-ages cartoon or a kid's cartoon or something that is really designed entirely for an adult sensibility, like children should not watch or on what? How would you find children? Where do y'all come down on that?
If I could misquote Clone High and take us way, way back to the 1990s, there's a big old list of stuff that the esteemed Mr. Sindelar has provided us with, and near the top of it is something that comes to mind when it comes to defining adult animation, and that is the Jason Alexander starring Duckman, which is a great show. It's filthy. It's silly. It's ridiculous. It was rather unique at the time in that I guess kids could watch it because I watched it and I was a kid. But the same thing could be said about Night Court, and Night Court wasn't really made for kids. That's very much, you know, to me, the dividing line is, was this made such that adults and kids could watch it, which more and more stuff is being made that way now. But there was very much a clear divide between things. It doesn't necessarily need to go to Ralph Bakshi territory.
Please no.
I don't know that anything needs to go to that territory.
please God.
But it's really something that for quite a while came down to, in Western animation specifically, that kind of a clear dividing line. Now, Eastern animation, things have been all over the map for a long time. And that goes to a lot of the source material that anime's adapted from, where, you know, you would see salary men headed to their, you know, job on the subway reading manga. And still to this day, it's kind of a, what is that grown man doing reading Miss Marvel on the train? Where there's a very different cultural sensibility about it. So the ease of access to stuff from Eastern animation changing over the last 20, 30 years has made it so that we see more of that stuff and see how much more common it was that loads and loads of stuff, you know, was made specifically with an adult audience in mind, and that bleed over line, you know, adults and kids welcome sort of thing is something that's been around in anime for a while. And of course, you know, you've also got cultural differences to take into account when it comes to the appropriateness of certain kinds of situations and so on. But for me, in my personal history, the dividing line was Duckman. That was Duckman. Me understanding that this is something that it's not that I'm not allowed to watch it. It's that it wasn't really made for me, but I guess it's okay for me to watch it.
Moises, I'm so glad that you made a distinction between Eastern and Western cultural conventions in animation, because one of the things that I was thinking about when Glenn posed this question is that in Western animation, stuff that's made for adults is a lot more comfortable with ambiguity, and it's a lot more comfortable with a lack of emotional catharsis and a closer reading to the everyday adult experience. And what I've noticed from watching anime or, you know, even Japanese animated movies is those stories tend to be very comfortable with ambivalence and a lack of emotional buildup in a way that Western stories overtly are not. And what I've noticed in animation for children versus animation for adults is that in animation that's explicitly aimed towards a kid audience is you almost always have a practically Aristotelian Ars Poetica type arc where the conflict is laid out very clearly. Even if they're shading to the villain, for example, in She-Ra, like the whole point of that series is villain becomes, you know, hero and finds love. But there's a really clear moral arc and there's really clear emotional catharsis and really clear resolution of that conflict. And what I've noticed is in stuff that's aimed at adults is that's not always going to be the case, because the people who write that have calculated that adults have more tools in their toolkit for sitting in that liminal space or that not resolved space and being able to still like enjoy or engage in the story.
I remember growing up watching Battle of the Planets, which, you know, it was just after Star Wars. It's a spacey adventure. And there, even as a child, there were parts of it that seemed odd, right? The animation styles didn't quite mesh, right? And, you know, here's one character who is totally isolated in one spot, never interacts with anybody else except by voice. Like, all right, that's a little weird. And every now and then, like, Turner Broadcasting would try and repurpose it under a new name with new character names, and it would get more and more juvenile as it went.
G-Force.
And I forget what the third one was. Was it Eagle Force or something like that? And when I discovered Gatchaman, I was like, ooh, I recognize this. Let's delve into this. Now, this is a few years ago. This is when it was still hard to find these things. And wow, it is totally different from Battle of the Planets. It is not aimed at children whatsoever. And
incredibly violent.
Incredibly violent, sexually ambiguous. There's depth to the characters. It's kind of astonishing. And now I much prefer that. The Battle of the Planets theme by Hoyt Curtin is a great theme song. But aside from that,
save that for the theme song animated cartoon draft, which we should be doing.
And so it was like that to me was a certain line. It was like before that, I didn't realize how much had been repurposed and cut and changed and edited to be palatable to America or even to be aimed at the wrong audience. You know, that was not the audience it was aimed at in Japan.
Well, it's the rise of cable TV, right? This is our, I mean, that's kind of the, that's the Duckman thing too. I looked it up, by the way. Duckman was 1994. Right? That's, you know, now I feel old or not quite as old. I don't know. It seems like it's, it's when I was still in my 20s. But
well, I remember that was, it was wacky because it was a cartoon scheduled at 10:30 at night on a Saturday night.
Yeah. And stay up and watch it. It was like appointment TV for, again, for adults or a
DVR. I was in my 20s. So
we didn't have DVRs. What am I saying? I said a DVR in 1994. I don't think so. I don't know what time is. This point at which I think cable networks, it seemed like they suddenly had enough money that they could commission or, you know, take on series, right? So that's kind of the beginning point, because networks were so, even with some shows that were on at that time, I think they're still pretty conservative, and nobody felt that adults would watch much animation. That was the other part. So it's kind of the education thing.
And you had The Simpsons breakout, but that was kind of all ages once it became a series. Mm-hmm. But then you had Fish Police and Capital Critters.
I was like, is someone going to mention Fish Police?
I'm totally going to mention Fish Police.
Who will speak for Fish Police?
Only
3 episodes have aired. And Glenn, you don't need to know anything past the title.
It's
all packed in there. But David, would you remind people the premise of Capital Critters, a show I also can't really believe existed?
I remember when it premiered, because all the hype was from Stephen Botchko, the creator of Cop Rock.
Yeah, thank you.
Come on.
Amazing.
Mention a good show. But
Capital Critters is about mice and, I believe, cockroaches?
All the vermin living in the White House.
Yes.
1992.
So you're talking about an elected official and their staff? Is that it?
Yes. No, Capital Critters was insane. You think Cop Rock is nuts.
This is 1992. I mean, I think Moises is on to Duckman was probably a success. These are shows that, you know, aired a couple episodes.
It was the first one
that were forgotten. Hit. Yeah. These were experiments.
They had to die to fertilize the ground that Duckman sprang from.
Duckman is a pyramid that they are these people are buried inside as workers. So, yes.
But also you had the big difference being that Fish Police, Family Dog, all those were on broadcast TV.
Yeah.
And broadcast TV didn't have the patience, didn't want to have the long lead time, didn't have any need for, you know, we need identity, we need this show. Whereas USA Network is like, we're wacky, we put weird things on Saturday nights, let's do it. And it just sustained because enough people liked it.
John, what's your experience of this era? Were you an animation fan in those days?
Well, I'm an animation fan going way back. I think the thing about the early 90s, I mean, Duckman was certainly an outlier, and that was based upon the creator's comic book that he'd done. And so it kind of came out of sort of something else. I think that a lot of the animation out of the 90s came ultimately from things like the Spike and Mike festivals that were going on in colleges at the time, that all were about being as extreme and as violent and as norm tweaking as they could be. And even kids shows, cartoons shows at that time partook in some of the sort of aggressively ugly stylings of that. You know, I always think Rugrats is kind of made to look.
All the Klasky Supo shows.
Right. Yeah. All those things. But you know, a lot of that was, you know, I love Duckman, but all I can think of when I think back on that was there was a show on MTV called The Brothers Grunt. Which was like everything that was wrong with early 90s animation. It was, there was no premise other than you watched these strange people make faces like they were going to have an aneurysm for like a half an hour. And then they would show music videos in between it. It made sense, I guess, in the time. But you know, I always feel like with when we talk about adult animation, there's always one or two outliers of people trying to do something really interesting in the animation field. And then there's like one primary model that everyone else latches onto. And unfortunately, I think that since the early 2000s, that primary model has been Family Guy. Yeah. Because yeah. every damn thing that Netflix does that's not Tuca and Birdie or BoJack Horseman seems to have that same bland, flat look. And it's all about like cutaway jokes. And
I mean, hasn't Seth MacFarlane, isn't he trying to basically reinvent Family Guy? Over
yeah, pretty
over
much.
Again? it came in, but worked out once. Yeah, I was going to say, I like the series Big Mouth on Netflix. And mm-hmm. I think the writing is nuanced. And I like that the creators have made an effort to address screw ups that they've made with characters and voice acting decisions and plot lines and do better each season. I think that's important. But yeah, it's basically like a really filthy Family Guy.
what Family Guy would be if he could get away with it.
John brought up MTV animation, and that makes me think of Liquid Television, which I came to late in its run.
Oh, yeah, which was incredible.
MTV's Oddities, yes.
MTV's Oddities.
Eon Flux came out of that.
The Head. Did anybody but me watch The Head?
The Head, yeah. I watched The Head. Yeah.
I thought The Head was... It was clever. The Max, and I went back and read the comic books The Max was based on because I didn't understand the show, and the show is so beautiful and stylized. I'm like, this is totally incomprehensible in its source form, too. But The Max was beautiful and strange and defied any clear interpretation. So it was almost like a surreal, gorgeous thing, kind of in the middle of that sort of brutalist animation style that John was talking about.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Should we move ahead to the future? I kind of want to, I mean, we laid some groundwork here, but I'd like to talk about some more recent stuff, and then we'll devolve into the past a bit more and talk some more about these earlier eras, because I'm curious what people are watching. You know, I mentioned some newer shows, like we did the episode on Invincible. There's a lot that just came out, and, you know, I don't want to say I was traumatized by Hitmonkey, which I understand was not renewed, so you get one season, folks. But it was weird, and I mean, I've now gone back and read some of the comic books, so I get the sensibility they were trying to bring too. It was so ultra violent and so beautiful in certain ways, and but you know, difficult to watch because of the amount of gore. You know, are there any recent shows that people have watched, some of the stuff that's come out during pandemic, that really brings to you like this, maybe the divide from the, you know, the 30-year divide from the start of a lot of this, or that you say, oh man, I really want to talk about, you know, X because.
Well, so there was a show that everyone was telling me, oh, you have to watch this. You're going to love it. And I looked, and the creator of it was from Rick and Morty, and I don't like Rick and Morty. I don't like the style. I don't like the just, I don't know. It's just the general, I'm kind of tired of Dan Harmon. So it's like, okay. And so I avoided, no. And I watched the first 5 minutes of Star Trek Lower Decks and went, oh no, I don't like this. And then stayed away from it for the whole first season. And then last summer, after I had a little hospital stay, I came home and it was like, well, I got to rest and I'll try it again because everyone keeps telling me I need to watch it. And I got past that first 5 minutes where the characters are acting too stupid to live. And then I go, oh, well, there's a point to them acting too stupid to live. And by the end of the first season, I was like, where's season two? What do you mean I have to wait a couple of weeks?
That's good because I didn't get past the first 5 minutes and everyone's been telling me how much they love it. So now I need to go to the hospital
I would advise skipping that part, but yeah.
David, what you're saying is we were all right and you were very wrong.
Right. Yes, in this case, you were all right.
What sensibility does Lower Decks have that you, when you broke through that you liked? I mean, other people can jump in since I haven't watched it, but what's the sensibility there that makes it work for you?
The creator also had his Twitter feed of TNG season 8, which I did follow. And when yes. I made that connection, I was like, oh, it's that guy.
Yeah.
And I realized, even though that was a funny Twitter feed, he got the idea of Trek stories. They're all pretty plausible as next generation stories, right? Even though they're sometimes silly. And he really gets Star Trek as much as well.
At like at a deep, deep love of Star Trek. Not yes. he's into Star Trek in an ironic way. Not he's into like, well, Star Trek is this pop culture thing that everyone is familiar with. Not, you know, I watch Star Trek, but now I'm too cool for it. It's like, no, the guy who makes that is very, very
he
into
loves
Star Trek.
It. Yes. Yeah, it's reverent irreverence.
Yes. And
oh,
you know,
that's the
will
best
he,
type because will, it's people who love something
it?
Enough to yeah.
A little bit, but mm. then it's almost like he's making fun of himself a little bit more than anything because it goes deep into what about Star Trek is lovely and also what about Star Trek is ridiculous.
Like it's kind of like you have fan service and then you have this deeper level of this is uber fan service and then you get further down and you have Lower Decks, which just he like this is in his blood, right? Yes.
There are jokes in Lower Decks that are just like, this is for someone who's watched Star Trek TNG 10 times and nobody else.
I mean, they're basic setup things about it that are, hey, you watched all of the animated series. You're one of the 12 of us.
Yeah.
Guess what? This is for you. We're going to make the Doctor a cat alien that was only ever seen on the animated show.
And in a way where if you don't get it, it's
still
works.
It doesn't matter.
It moves on.
It still works. Yeah. I mean, as much as I enjoy Discovery, and I do, and as much as I've enjoyed Picard, season one I really enjoyed, and season two is also present. But Lower Decks, I gotta say, Lower Decks is the new Trek series that really gets Star Trek and does it right until Strange New Worlds came on. I mean, it is probably the best of the shows until Strange New Worlds showed up.
I think I love them all. If you have donated, if you have invested several hundred of hours of your life in Star Trek already, you need Lower Decks. That this is where that investment pays off.
Yeah.
Finally,
whoever you are, and there is one episode that there is one episode in the second season that might be one of the best Trek stories ever. It's just so beautifully told and framed and set up. Oh,
that said, it is not a show to watch with. Children, unless your children are very mature,
but then they're not children, are they?
No, I have literally told my children sometimes they're like, oh, can we watch whatever? I said, yeah, when you're 50. And they're like, how are you going to enforce that? I'm like, I will somehow.
I'll keep you on my Netflix account and change the password constantly.
Glenn, you actually bring up something interesting that I don't think we've talked about yet, is, well, we alluded to it a little bit about the airtime of Duckman. Everything goes back to Duckman, apparently.
Oh, this is a great point. Yeah, absolutely.
Back in the day, you had to have access to the television at the time when a thing was on.
Oh my gosh.
And these days, it is a matter of which stream you are bathing in and don't find yourself locked out of thanks to the parental controls.
parental controls.
I love that sentence because it implies that in Moises' household, he's at the mercy of someone messing with the parental controls.
Well, I mean, that's the only way I can control myself.
The parental controls are how my children control me, actually.
mine figured out how to circumvent them.
That's a great point, though. Yeah, it's because you're right. You can watch anywhere, anytime. It makes it tough as a parent because it brings up that whole discussion. You know, I was alluding to that, like adult cartoons. That's where we come up with like Ralph Bakshi and like actual cartoons that are full of, you know, graphic sex, and that used to be ultra violence and graphic sex or both, and now it's But the sex part was the stuff that you were trying to keep the kids away from, I guess. I don't know. It's the
purity thing.
Well,
it depends
how
you feel about violence.
Yeah. But you know, just from a societally. But it brings up the whole issue of like, what am I trying to protect my children against? And, you know, it's often like, I don't want my kids to see things that their developing minds are not prepared for, but I don't want them to be naive. And I don't think I can do that entirely. John, you have grown children. Maybe you have some insight into this from the pre-streaming era a little bit. Sorry.
John's on the other side of the wall.
My grown kids watch you know, anime in Japanese. I don't follow it. You know, they seem very happy with it. So, you know, and I don't think at this point I'm going to dictate any of their tastes.
Did you have to put walls in place or try, or were they,
you know, I was a bad parent. I let them watch everything. You know, from a very early age, you know, I was the permissive parent, and they got tired of my stuff pretty quickly and went on to their stuff.
Sure. There's two types of parents, really. The parents who let their kids watch everything, and the parents whose kids have to figure out how to watch everything.
And then you have to figure out as a kid, which house you go to because their parents let them watch everything.
And yeah. I don't have children, but. As a child growing up in the 90s, who was very interested in, especially what Moises has already kind of introduced, the interesting idea of what, you know, anime brought us. And I remember, you know, you'd go to Blockbuster and they'd have Ninja Scroll and Akira, and those were the only things you could get. And they'd have stickers on them that said, this is not for kids, because the assumption was all animated things for kids. But, you know, as a teen, I was taking the subway downtown and getting bootleg anime from Chinatown and from people out the MIT campus. And I don't know. What are you going to do to stop me? Now you don't even have to get on the subway. It comes via the internet. Room. Yeah.
Well, and it's so. Like my mother raised me the same way she was raised too. Of you can read any book in this house as long as we discuss it, it was never a problem. And that's how we've been with TV for the most part too. And you know, every now and then it's like, you know, the 20-year-old came out the other month and was like, Have you seen Invincible? I'm like,
oh my
god, you've seen Invincible? Okay. And he goes, yeah, it's great. You got to watch it.
So I'm at the other end of this because mine is 11, and she's just getting to a point. It's kind of an awkward age because the stuff that's explicitly aimed at kids is getting too young for her. But I'm still where if I watch Big Mouth on Netflix, I delete it so that she doesn't see it pop up in my queue. And I find that show to be both great and frustrating because it really is it's kind of a pitch perfect note on how confusing and disorienting it can be to be in middle school. But at the same time, some of the jokes are so unbelievably adult and Family Guy-ish. I don't feel comfortable showing it to her in an, oh, honey, this experience is universal, because no, not all the experiences are universal.
Well, but, I'll put it this way, Lisa. Would you show your kid Night Court?
No, that's mostly because I object to that format. No, I mean, this goes back 20 years,
but I have a friend who I think 5 or 6 year old, they were watching King of the Hill together, you know, Simpsons King of the Hill block in the day. And his wife forbade the child from watching that after that, because after watching it one night, the kid comes up and says, "Where's my meal, woman?" and slaps his mother on the ass. And I think my friend had been not necessarily being fully disclosing to his wife that the kid was watching that show with him until that moment. But so, you know, you have that kind of thing, which is, you know, I don't mean to say that cartoons promote antisocial or inappropriate behavior, because that would be playing into the hands of the Puritans.
The King of the Hill mention behooves me to say that when people ask where I'm from in Texas, King of the Hill was based on my hometown. And the name of the town is a melding of Garland, where I'm from, and Arlington. Yeah. And that's how they came up with Arlen. And there were a lot of guys talk like this in my neighborhood.
Oh my god.
Just remember basically that the psychic roots of Hank Hill are firmly in the neighbor from Beavis and Butthead, where he'd be like, "I was too whacking off in my pool shed." Just like the first time I saw King of the Hill, I was like, there we go.
Lisa, you bring up Beavis and Butthead, and I feel like the assistant commentator on Iron Chef bringing up referential information. Paramount Plus is in debuting a new Beavis and Butthead movie this month.
What?
They're also bringing back the entire original run of episodes with all of the music videos restored for the first time.
The music videos? Oh my gosh.
All of them, the way that they originally aired.
Oh, it's when Beavis goes into a fugue state and begins discoursing on grunge. That's like one of the greatest moments in that series.
Oh, finally, Lisa, culture.
Oh my gosh. I feel like I'm having like a schism man feeling where I'm like whingy or flying back and forth decades in time. Like, oh, Beavis Butthead. Oh, ah! It's actually very Star Trek feeling right now.
Well, and of course I didn't watch a lot of Beavis and Butthead, but I fell in love with Daria, the spinoff.
Oh,
yeah. And
yeah,
watched
okay,
it
nerd.
Thoroughly at the time. Yeah. But then I also fell in love with a short-lived MTV series with the same designer.
Yeah.
Right. If you see it, it's all on YouTube except for one episode. It's a show called Spy Groove, which is about two secret agents, mm-hmm. one who looks like Ben Affleck and one who looks like Matt Damon, but you only ever know them by their numbers. And their boss, Helena Troy, she's mighty, mighty. They do that in like every episode. Like, it was a show, I think MTV only ran the first six episodes, but it has this really wonderfully weird pop culture, fashion, celebrity focus in the context of these dopey sci-fi, not sci-fi, but secret agent stories. And it has taken forever. I thought this show was lost. It came out in like 2000 and ran till 2001 up in Canada. And all but one of the episodes are up on YouTube now, as of a couple of months ago. And the one that isn't up there is because it's set in Manhattan and the Twin Towers are a huge visual motif through the whole episode. And it's the French version of it is up on YouTube. It's really difficult to watch, even though it's like, you know, it's just a cartoon. But that came out like a couple of weeks before 9/11. So
coming soon to the network this summer, David Lohr's Did You Know That It Was Canceled? What do you mean you didn't know that it exists?
That's every.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I'm going to pull us back to the future. I'm going to yank my time chain because I want to talk a little bit about talk about some series people have seen. Now, it sounded like some folks had seen The Legend of Vox Machina. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Because my 15-year-old became a big D&D head and had been watching the group group of wonderful people who've raised millions of dollars to do their own work, which is incredible. And so they were very excited about the show. I knew nothing about it. And I thought, well, I've heard great things about these people, whatever. We turned it on. And I'm like, the first scene has like, a graphic sex scene, just not quite like sort of softcore pornography level. And I'm like, all right, this is what we're getting into. But they're 15. We'll, 14 going on 15. We'll work through this. And I thought it was, so it's got great fantasy elements. It's I like creator-driven stuff where these people are down in the trenches and they made this thing. There's aspects of the D&D campaigns that the group was doing are built in. So Alex would be like, oh yeah, that's from that campaign. Oh, I recognize that. Oh, I don't know what's going to happen next. So they had a little bit of a narrative to hang on it, but I thought it was one of the, I enjoyed the animation style and I actually thought it was one of the more enjoyable fantasy oriented cartoon series I've seen, and I'm eager for more. I don't know if other people mm-hmm. shared my opinion or
I really
too
liked
much.
It.
I love it.
I watched along with our friend Monty did a not episode by episode, but chunks of episode by chunks of episode recap podcast with it. So I would do my thing where I'd watch a chunk and then listen to Monty and Reyes talk about it. And no, I enjoy it. I mean, as some people may know, I'm a little familiar with the game Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm. Oh, really?
This is the most Dungeons and Dragons thing there is. The serial numbers are filed off for trademark reasons, but this is more Dungeons and Dragons than any actual existing licensed Dungeons and Dragons media, in terms of actually getting the sensibilities of you know, what people are like when they play D&D.
Oh, yeah, there's a bit where they can't get through the door, and Alex is telling me they can't get through the door. This is a joke because, so I have my concierge, my D&D concierge, as Alex has previously been established in campaigns that I've done with you all. But it was great because Alex is like, oh yeah, you see the joke there? And I'm like, oh, now I get it. That's a D&D joke. They can't, nothing they do will get them through the door.
Oh, Glenn, I will forever cherish like the memory of playing D&D with you and seeing Alex standing over your shoulder, intently watching every one of your moves and like whispering to consult
judging,
with you.
Judging all of us.
And like whispering to consult. It was like having a consigliere, like he was some sort of D&D mafia dog.
Just taking the dice out of your hand. No, Dad, that's not, no. So that's not how you roll for initiative.
Absolutely. It was so great.
It was wonderful. And it was so, imagine that with Vox, Legend of Vox Machina.
Yes.
Tom Hayden lives.
I think those episodes will air in 2025, Tony. I'm not sure when they... Oh,
I believe they've all aired.
You can find those on the Incomparable Network, folks. But so Legend of Vox Machina had a really grown-up, even adult sensibility to the extent that I was like, is this a show I should watch with my teenager? And the answer is yes, because it was a great bonding experience. We both liked it a lot. We were Amazon was releasing them episode like one or two a week or something. They did two, and then so we had to actually wait for it, and we would be like, is it out yet? And Alex would be like, it's Wednesday at 5, why haven't they posted the episode? And that was kind of exciting too, to have something something like that.
Something that we mention on occasion is that kids who predominantly understand televised programming through the streaming lens just don't understand some of the deserts that we went through where, you know, summer. We show them like show them something like Flash Gordon from 1980 and they go, why does this exist? Who allowed this to happen? In what world? And the answer is, you got to understand, we were lucky that we got that, because you've never seen Hawk the Slayer or Battle Beyond the Stars. It could have been a lot worse. And for me, Vox Machina is this incredible progression of those nerds who the only D&D content that they had in the media was the animated show from the 80s. Now have this thing that has grown up with them, that allows them to, you know, watch something in animation that is, I guess, at our grade level now. And I think that spiritually there's something really beautiful about that we've gotten to the point where animation focused on adults is such a thing that it's like, oh yeah, guess what? The people who are making all the decisions in those front offices were watching the crummy cartoons in the 1980s, like Conan the Adventurer and whatever. And now they're the ones calling the shots when it comes to what is getting made.
Hey, Lisa, I want to point to you, because I know I think you may have been the person to turn me onto the She-Ra series, which I also watched with Alex, and I've watched it twice. I loved it. And then we have Masters of the Universe Revelation. I know that you have an interest in that era and those shows. And how do those fit into this rubric? Are they grown up? I mean, there was a lot of winks and nods to adults, I felt, particularly in the Revelation series.
So I didn't watch the Revelation series, and I can't speak to that.
I highly recommend it. I think you'll like it.
I can speak to She-Ra. I don't feel like it's an adult series because and the reason I say that is because very nearly every hyper conscientious parent I know was perfectly fine with their elementary school age daughter watching it. because even if we have these rubrics like, well, it depends on the narrative complexity, or well, is it made for children or whatever, mine. Like, I think one of the litmus tests for is something made for adults or made for kids is how much do parents react or overreact when they find their children watching it? I do think that She-Ra is actually one of those rare tween / middle grade type. It's going for an audience that is itself beginning to grapple with, you know, the fact that sometimes your friends can be crappy to you, or sometimes you and your friend don't have things in common anymore, or
and sometimes you have a crush on your friend.
Exactly. Yeah. Or and you don't know who you are, or your parents are, or this is the first time in your life you're discovering that my parents are full of crap. you know, so it is in many ways a real coming of age show. And I don't think it was made for grownups. I think it was made for people who are coming of age as adults. And that is really not tied to chronology. That's tied to like emotions and intellectual development and sexuality and social development and all that. So I think it's like that really weird perhaps even scantier than adult, well, actually adult animation stick on the ground, but it's a really weird, really liminal category, which is this is a show that's made for people who aren't quite kids and aren't quite adults.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because I think the He-Man show is a more, or the Masters of the Universe show has a stronger delineation. I mean, made by Kevin Smith also, but it's not that it's more adult, but I think it crosses. I think it's on the other side of that line where She-Ra, there's difficult moral choices and ambiguity, and people who are bad get to become good, and some people you think are good are not as good as you thought. And in Revelation, I think there's a lot more. Shading, there's like some body horror stuff, there's constant betrayal, there's a lot of, you know, oh, my parents are full of crap in the end because they can't cope with this kind of thing, but I felt like it dealt with like bigger, like moral and existential issues, but in a perfectly lovely and ridiculous comics content that cartoon context that referred to itself. But I think there's a continuum between the two, and I would recommend you watch it too, because you probably like
possibly
it.
The most adult thing about it, having to withstand Henry Rollins's voice acting. I love what Lisa pointed out about the middle reader place that She-Ra falls into. I know loads of adults like myself who loved it as well, and it is within that beautiful intermediary space that it has more advanced things for more advanced humans when they can wrap their heads around it, but it doesn't prevent an 11-year-old, for example, from enjoying it. Masters of the Universe Revelation is explicitly made for those of us either who still have or whose parents still have giant plastic tubs of He-Man toys from the 1980s,
yeah.
Complete with battle damage and, you know, the ones that you could get at the store because Skeletor was all sold out. And Kevin Smith show running it from an explicitly, we are going to continue and conclude the story that was started and never really finished.
Yeah,
that is its own genre of stuff where it's okay. Now, 20 years later, we're going to do this, or 30 years later, in some cases, we're going to, you know, complete the version of things that you didn't know, which it kind of makes me want to jump to something that we haven't addressed that also ties to another thing that we talked about. We talked about Liquid Television, and it was kind of a proving ground, and you know, that's where you saw Aeon Flux, and it was a sort of like a film festival shorts program of all kinds of different stuff. And that model is something that Adult Swim, basically loads of shows that are now considered, you know, their classics, like Squidbillies or things, were micro shorts, yeah, in between their existing 12-minute shows. And those shows, I include with them, even though it wasn't explicitly an Adult Swim show, The Venture Brothers, which was definitely leaning toward adult thing that was sort of kind of a riff on Johnny Quest, but then was also a riff on a dozen other things over the course of its run. There was a lot of that sensibility built into it, where the people on William Street got to just play around occasionally with existing Turner Network properties, like in the case of Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law, one of the great animated shows of all time.
C-Lab.
We got to talk C-Lab. About
You know, you look at it as what they did with spare parts other people would never use. And it's I think it's a wonderful look at a corporate parent having a bunch of stuff that they have literally no use for or don't even know that they have. That they had these, you know, 28-year-olds going, hey, can we use blah, blah, blah? Yeah, sure. Whatever. Drive it around the block. Crash it into a tree. We don't care.
The metaphorical plastic tub full of characters.
Yeah. No, there's a clear dotted line from MTV in the 90s to Adult Swim in the 2000s. Probably in part from MTV doing more reality television and things like that. I'm not sure, and maybe it's because I'm old, what is the Adult Swim of today? And maybe it's like it's on some part of the web that they don't let olds into.
It's still kind of Adult Swim?
I guess I'm skeptical.
Sometimes you open up HBO Max and it is promoting to you the new Bird Girl show starring Padgett Brewster that directly continues the Harvey Birdman stuff, but centering on Bird Girl.
Well, and the thing that was amazing about the beginning of Adult Swim was how cheaply everything was made, because who's going to mess around with Space Ghost or Sea Lab? You know, those shows aren't going anywhere. There's no one clamoring for them. And Sea Lab, at least in the very beginning, was literally just re-edited footage from the actual show.
Yes.
And maybe I'm just asking kids to get off my lawn, but it felt like there was a experimental nature to this of, we will put anything on the TV and see what hits, that I don't think they have anymore today. And I'm not sure where that is. That, you know, that basically their popularity means that they can't do that anymore.
Well, I wonder if YouTube is where it's going, because yeah, you'll have folks on YouTube who do it.
I mean, animation, it was mentioned earlier, you know, maybe during the pandemic, it was just cheaper. Animation isn't cheaper to do, but during the pandemic, it was the only thing that could keep going. Because instead of recording people at a studio, you just have them record at home.
Yeah.
And unlike all the live action stuff that completely hit a work stoppage, you know, animation found a way. In the case of Adult Swim, at a certain point, even the cheapest version of stuff, which was, hey, just re-edit stuff, yeah, even that became, I guess, you know, Turner came back to them and said, could you do anything cheaper and have it look crappier?
Yes.
Because that's really what we want. And so, I, no offense intended, but then, you know, one of my college pals, Henry Zabrowski, is the lead on Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, which is people, you know, wearing like Party City grade makeup and costumes doing live action stuff in short form. And a lot of Adult Swim for a certain time became less about animation and more about how cheap can we do funny stuff for adults.
Yeah. And like recently FX had the anthology show Cake, I think it was.
Mm.
That was,
which John Hodgman's short is on that.
Well, and, I was just gonna say, they spun off John Hodgman's Dicktown.
Dicktown is the name of the show. It's not something that gets us an explicit tag. We're being accurate by saying Dicktown, right, about a show called Dicktown.
It's Richardville, right? Richardville.
Dicktown,
right.
Yes.
Richardville. And it's a wonderful show with a lot of heart, surprisingly a lot.
Well,
of
I'll
heart.
Debate you on that, but that's right. I thought
from Duckman to Dicktown.
I want to call out the John McCoy, set up the John McCoy flare gun though, because John, what have you been watching lately in this genre? Because I want to make sure
you know,
we're getting different.
I mentioned before that I really don't like how similar these things have become to one another, and even, you know, Vox Machina,
Legend of Vox Machina. Yeah, I know.
Legend of Vox Machina. I watched that and it was okay for me, but it felt to me like the animation style was very like the same kind of style that had been brought down from the 90s superhero cartoons to the present day via, you know, there's a kind of a Family Guy style and there's this kind of superhero style. Mm-hmm. So the things that I've been watching have been the strangest things I can find. You know, I loved The Midnight Gospel. I thought that was an amazing show, and it did something completely different. Its goals were different. Its methodology was different. It was, I thought, a great show. You know, I always feel like Netflix gets their hands on something interesting, and then they drop it right away. I loved Tuca and Birdie. I actually think Tuca and Birdie is closer to Lisa Hanawalt's Strange Imagination than BoJack Horseman was. She was just the art director for that, but this is kind of her channeling her inner animal creatures. And I thought that was an amazing show, an amazing show centered on female friendship and a particularly female view of the world. And of course, that meant Netflix canceled it after a season. It's been picked up by Adult Swim, but I feel like in the interim, they must have lost some of their budget, because the newer shows seem to be not as animated as the old ones. But the one show that I do want to give a shout out for is, you know, Netflix has this you know, I actually rue the fact that Netflix has gotten all this bad press and lost all this stuff, because one of the fun things about Netflix was it started to just like try everything, and they brought in so many international shows that you would never see. There's been this whole wave of international shows, and there is an Italian cartoon called Tear Along the Dotted Line that is done, that is based on the on the cartoons of a Italian cartoonist named Zero Calcare, and I think everyone should watch this. It's a very short series, and everyone should actually watch it in Italian with the subtitles, because the humor is very Italian, and again, it's I don't think we're going to see another one of these from Netflix anytime soon.
Oh, that's interesting. Hey, tell me a little more. Atuca and Birdie, I mean, I think that's a show that got a lot of attention. And I could never quite, this is a confessions episode, right, where we talk about David revealing he's tired of Dan Harmon and at this point and so forth. I try to watch BoJack Horseman. I watched a bunch of episodes and I eventually found it to be a, this kind of hit me at points with Futurama, though I love the show, is there's a point at which there's no morality in a thing. And people feel to be like they're being rewarded for being moral voids. And I kind of, sometimes I want to see that, but I never watched Breaking
Where
Bad
Where did you
either.
Leave off with BoJack Horseman?
Oh, probably too soon, right? Is there a long arc?
Yeah, there's an arc to that. That does not, That is not the message of that show.
unfortunately, BoJack Horseman leads with like the six weakest episodes of the series.
No, I watched a couple of years of it, I felt like, but.
But it gets better and better as it goes along.
The last season of BoJack is amazing. Definitely not for children. Never, ever, ever for children. It's another one I also delete from my Netflix queue so that my daughter doesn't see that I'm watching it. but I will say the back half of the final season is absolutely worth everything, that all the time and attention you put into the rest of it. I hate bandwagoning with all the other critical types, like, oh, BoJack Horseman, like Hearts in the Eyes and all that. But like the final few episodes, especially the second to last one, is just, oh my God, loved it.
I mean, when they're right, they're right.
I want to bring, I want to circle back very briefly though. So Tuca and Birdie, in contrast to my initial impression of BoJack Horseman, or after, you know, like I say, a couple seasons of it, I felt like it had a lot of heart, but it was, John, as you say, it represented her maybe initial intent of the artist a little more, because it's sort of surreal and everything is alive. Everything is alive. And it reminded me in some ways of was it Raw, the Art Spiegelman, Francoise Moly publication, where that was hugely influential on me as kind of a late teen, early 20s person reading alternative comics all stuck together, because I hadn't found those in other ways. I hadn't gone to the alternative comics shops and events or whatever existed at the time. And I felt Tuca and Birdie had kind of that, but so did, and this is my weird transition, is Centaur World, which was also about everything being sort of animated. Everything was alive, just about, like trees and weird things. There's a tree running around complaining about its jean jacket the entire two seasons of it's so strange, but its sensibility is almost like the plant woman in the same apartment building as, I don't know if it's Tuca or Birdie, I can't remember. It has that same, like, you feel slightly unhinged watching it. And Centaur World, Lisa, correct me if I'm wrong. Was that made for children? It was made for children? I can't tell.
It was made for children, but it works for adults. Mm. And again, this is another one where all of the kids of the people who I know are extremely conscientious parents were the ones who were singing Comfortable Doug on the playground.
Oh my God. I really hated Comfortable Doug's character. There was some character design in it that made me physically ill in Centaur World. In other parts, I'm like, this is the most delightful thing. It's the most extraordinarily produced, weird. It's the weirdest thing I'd ever seen, I think, just about, besides Tuca and Birdie.
Like, I know we've been bagging a little bit on Ralph Bashke, but I have a feeling the aesthetic behind Centaur World is going to be to this generation what like Ralph Bashke was to us growing up, where when we're adults, we'll still have like a really visceral reaction to some of the stuff that we've seen.
Yeah, that's true.
But Centaur World, and I don't, were we chatting about this before we started recording, where like you mentioned that Centaur World is basically body horror, and I'm like, with a Broadway soundtrack. Yeah. And that's exactly what it is.
That was before recording. Yeah. Body horror with a Broadway soundtrack is probably not our episode title, but it is, but it's amazing to me that they were allowed to experiment with it, because it's so weird, and it's got this great little, it's got a really beautiful arc, the two seasons, like really an amazing bit of storytelling, but it's also like, feels like, you know, sub Teletubbies humor at times, like really. And then some stuff is incredibly sophisticated, particularly in the music and the songs and beautiful singing voices, of course. And at the end, you're like, I got to the end of it, season two, and I'm like, oh, I'm strangely very satisfied with how they did all this. And I think you, I don't know if we want to talk about it because it's too much of a spoiler. Go watch Centaur World. But there's something that happens in the last episode, Lisa, I think you may have mentioned on in our internal Slack, but it's like, it is so shocking to see that moment and to hear the words come out of this person's mouth, where I was like, okay, well, I don't know what this show was then because of that last, almost last shocking event that happens in it. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Oh, so my God.
Good, yeah. Good. And
it's just a murderer's row of Broadway show people, especially Megan Hilty, Leah Salonga, Kimiko Glenn. Yeah. They get, who is it? She was Angelica in Hamilton. I'm blanking on her name.
Renee Elise Goldsberry.
Yes, Renee Elise Goldsberry, like, brings it home in her solo as a giant hippopotamus. Brian Stokes Mitchell is the Nowhere King. Again, there were no stars left on the Great White Way because they were all in a recording booth singing.
some of it during pandemic, so they got paid while they couldn't perform.
All right, so good.
So I feel like it's not exactly an elephant in the room or a giant centaur hippo, but there's a show what prompted me wanting to do this episode was I got an HBO subscription, HBO Max, and I watched all of Harley Quinn over a period of, I don't know, a couple weeks, but that felt like, I was like, that is a show, right? We'll talk about that. But it's also, it felt like it was such, I just watched, I think, Invincible before it. I watched Hit Monkey after it. And I was like, oh my God, I know we're in a pandemic, but these shows were shot before it. And it felt like, not nihilism. I mean, I got to say, and I don't know, this is going to tell people whether like a lot about me. I thought Harley Quinn was one of the best animated series I've ever seen. And I don't know, maybe I'm giving away too much about myself that I thought that. What do people think who've seen it?
I had a Glenn's reaction to BoJack feeling about Harley Quinn.
Oh, yeah?
Starting it while a bit sleepy one night, and I got a few minutes into it and went, okay, I get it. It's a Harley Quinn show where they get to say this word and that word and this other thing, and they get to be hyper violent. Fine, whatever, I get it. Put it away, and then picked it back up after various people were just shouting and screaming its praises, and found myself completely won over by actually finishing the first episode. It's something that, I guess, to touch on things that we've said earlier, it's something that as a kid, as somebody who was a kid when Batman the Animated Series came out, which was itself a good deal more adult than the other stuff that was out there. It was an interesting look at various tropes and so on through a much more modern progressive lens than those characters were treated with back when Harley Quinn was created for that show. Where she was a clown gun mole, basically. And
I always loved her in that original incarnation too, as I just thought she would act, the voice acting, the characterization.
And this, I think, builds on some of the stuff in the recent comics where Harley is done with the Joker and has an evolving relationship with Poison Ivy, and also does the enjoyable thing of bringing in a variety of C-list DC villains and doing interesting takes with them. I speak
Kite
of
Man,
Kite Man.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
Kite Man, who Kite I think Man, you'd I have to be a relatively substantial Batman fan to be familiar with the works of Kite Man, but also reinterpretations of some of your even more popular
Condiment
villains.
Man. Is Condiment Man in the Harley Quinn series?
I'm sorry, Condiment King.
Excuse me. I mean,
put some respect
I knew who that
on
was.
His lordship's name.
I should mention Tony Sindelar has a degree in Batmanology as a PhD in that movie.
From an unaccredited institution. But, you know, Clayface,
University.
A version of King Shark I very much enjoy. There's a very different than the Suicide Squad version of King Shark.
Yeah, he's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I think the best moment, I got to say, and this is my highlight for the entire series, was the bit where Dr. Psycho says the C word is an incredible thing, because I love the notion that, like, these people are evil. They can do everything. They can, you know, and you're like, the League of, they must be giants, but what was it called? The evil league that Lex Luthor heads up?
The Legion of Doom.
Legion of Doom. I should remember that from my childhood. Legion of Doom. They put out a statement against Dr. Psycho because he used the C word, and then they kind of keep the joke going where, you know, nobody finds that admirable, and he turns out to be even less admirable than a supervillain should be, but everyone's really appalled with him. I was like, this is delightful. Like, there are limits to evil, and we've decided what they are.
I think the first couple episodes lean a little heavily on incredibly graphic violence.
Yes.
And isn't swearing inherently funny? perhaps, like, in a way that, like, maybe they I mean, I think that that works for a lot of people. I don't think that necessarily works for me, but I think that that is just bringing people in the door for a show that actually has a surprising amount of heart, for a show that also has people being decapitated and whatnot.
When I started watching it, I did not know there'd be any swearing in it. I didn't understand that it was, like, you know, what do you call it? Like, not X, but whatever rated. And I was like, the first time someone swore, I was like, wait, what? I'm like, oh, okay. It's that kind of deal. I didn't know.
Yeah. Not only do you get to hear Alan Tudyk as the Joker, you get to hear Alan Tudyk as the Joker cursing. I don't know. It's a wonderful show that I'm glad it originally launched as a DC Universe streaming service exclusive. And thankfully that got absorbed into HBO Max, and HBO Max just kept around stuff like this and Doom Patrol that were really good.
Right.
This show also marked the Giancarlo Esposito playing his second iconic DC villain in animation. He's now played both Ra's al Ghul and Lex Luthor, and eventually I'm sure that he'll play Darkseid and like every other villain in DC.
I want to do a little transition here, because we'll move towards the, I know we could talk for 5 hours about this, but let's, my transition before we do kind of a more bring out your dead, approach to this, make sure we talk about everything that folks had brought to the table that I'd like to talk about was, it's the, who was the audience for this that I hinted at it earlier. I have a list of shows on this. I'll read some of them out, and maybe we could talk about that. Is I feel like some shows are confused about whether they're for adults or children or all ages, or maybe they don't even know. And so my list includes Disenchanted, What If, which might be an unpopular or strange choice to put in there, Dicktown, Saturday Morning All-Star Hits, which is a mix of cartoons and live action, Centaur World, Q-Force, and Bird Girl. And so those are the ones I kind of was like, I've watched in some entire seasons of or all of. In other cases, I watched a few episodes and would skip ahead and watch some, and I just didn't get what sensibility they're going for. So I don't know if anyone objects to entries in that list, wants to debate me, or has their own kind of, who did they make this for? Did they understand it?
I mean, I mentioned Dicktown before, and it kind of took me by surprise, because again, you know, the first one or two, I was like, well, okay. And, you know, it's a little more scatological than I normally go for. And then it started to work on me. And by the end of the first series of it, I was like, all right, I would watch that if it came back. And the second season is a step up. They really start giving the characters depth, and heart. It's kind of surprising for such a delightfully vulgar show. And I love the fact that in every exterior shot, no matter where they are in Dicktown, no matter where they're looking around, you always see a church steeple. And nice. And the joke is that there are like 50,000 churches in this town. It's just one of those little tiny visual touches.
Did anybody else even see Saturday Morning All-Star Hits? I feel like it was.
I'm aware of it, but I haven't seen it.
It's an amazing piece of creeping horror, told both in cartoon and live action form. In some level ways, it's a little bit like Adventure Time a bit, but much more so Steven Universe, where things start out and you're kind of like la-di-da-di-da, and then you're like, oh no, but over six episodes. But I'm not sure who Saturday Morning All-Star Hits was for either.
I think it was for adults.
Probably.
I think.
I guess it was for people who remember the 80s really well, I guess.
Yeah.
I think there's a certain, Sometimes it lands, sometimes it doesn't. I think there's a certain set of animation that is made by people, and they tend to be, you know, young people, maybe not too far out of college, only for themselves. And they, and then they somehow then get it on TV or streaming, and that's fine. And those people find it. I mean, I think there's a whole section of Adult Swim that's like, can anyone over 24 really appreciate this? Or younger than 19?
You're not wrong.
And you know, I mean, is this made by people on drugs or made for people on drugs? And it's, you know, it works. There's a market.
Oh, I forget about that.
I mean, I love doing the will you get this reference? If I slip this into a thing, will you get it? And even if one person writes in and goes, oh my God, you used to watch the Skatebirds on CBS Saturday mornings in 1977? I'm like, yes, I did.
Oh my God.
It's like, all right, someone else got it.
The thing that immediately leapt out as Tony was describing that phenomenon was a show called Moonbeam City that was on Comedy Central, I don't know, half a decade ago, that I discovered on I don't remember which streaming service, that has, you know, Elizabeth Banks and Rob Lowe and Will Forte and Kate Mara and a bunch of well-known people on it that seems like it was explicitly made by somebody for their sensibility. And of course, nobody watched it.
I want to, before we finish out here, I want to bring up just Disenchanted for a moment, because I think Disenchanted got a lot of attention as, you know, Matt Groening's next show. Netflix was backing it. It's had it had a 4-season run, and I think, yeah, 4th season is at, I think it's 4. Excuse me. And I watched it through the first. I mean, it's funny because I think each season has, and a lot of even like episode has a different sensibility where you're like, oh, I could see a child watching that. And then you're like, oh my God, I would never want a developing mind to see that, because I think it's too hard for them to put into any kind of worldview they might have yet. Like, you need to live a life before seeing that episode. And, you know, and again, it's, I mean, we could talk even more generally about like the Adventure Time, Steven Universe, and Disenchanted, to lesser extent, all have that kind of, we start with one thing and then the world keeps getting bigger and bigger and you see how complicated things get. But Disenchanted, it felt like, I don't know, I don't feel like they ever got their feet, and I'm not sure what it was supposed to be, but it got, I felt like a lot of attention because it was Groening's project. I'm not sure if anybody else saw it. I think a couple of people might have mentioned it. Yeah.
I think the thing that, I feel like it's difficult to talk about Disenchanted without bringing up Futurama.
Yes.
Because there's a similar, hey, we're going to start with a big high concept thing, and a trigger warning for notions of self-harm. But in the first episode of Futurama, they introduce a thing in a primetime show that, you know, allegedly kids can watch. You know, our two main characters meet each other in line for a suicide booth.
Holy cow.
And for kids,
right? And there was more edginess, or at least playing on the edge, that Groening Co., as I think of that collective of folks, did on Futurama, that I think when Disenchanted was announced, the great hope was that, oh, this is going to be in this particular setting with this, you know, collection of characters, similar to the heights that Futurama once got to. And I think those expectations didn't end up helping the show, which, from friends I know who have watched all 4 seasons of it, they enjoy it and they think it's fine. I just haven't made time for it because I tried the first episode and I think my expectations were wildly out of whack with what they were trying to do. And, you know, some of that might be Netflix's marketing department's fault for promoting it as the next great animated series that will run for 30 years.
It's fine. It's probably, if you want to, it's hard to not compare it to Futurama because of who makes it and even the kind of visual style of it, and which kind of sets you up for disappointment because it's not Futurama. It's fine. There's the similar kind of comedy stylings. The characters are not as lovable. I mean, I think by intentional choice, which just doesn't land quite as well. They also seem a little bit more into like their own world building and the idea that that would be interesting than I think, at least for me, it is received by. So, you know, it's fine. It's not, you know,
I was bored by it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was especially bored. Later seasons.
I was bored because I don't think they did.
Probably not.
Yeah,
I don't think they did anything particularly interesting or innovative with the storytelling. The cliche of a princess who's unprincessy has been done to death at this point.
Yeah, I think they thought they were cutting edge and cool, and it's like. It
read very much like, oh, your grandma who reads Good Housekeeping is under the impression this is subversive. And it felt really formulaic. And we live in an era where there's just infinite numbers of formulas and infinite numbers of animated type shows. And if I want to watch a Futurama-like show, I'll watch Futurama. If I want to watch...
Whoa!
This available.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This didn't add anything new or interesting. It didn't seem to be made in a way where that indicated anybody involved was taken with the idea of trying to either say something insightful or new or funny or particularly original. There was no attempt to like push any sort of boundaries or even define them and then say, oh, we're up against them. Boink, boink, boink. It was just it had the feel of something somebody pulled out of a drawer.
Yeah.
And
apologies for the ageism, but it kind of feels like, did anyone under 50 work on this? Right?
The answer is,
oh my God, no,
I don't think
no,
so. It's all the original.
No, like I said, your grandma who worked on Good Housekeeping got like some sort of Grey Panther internship.
And I'm
in
not
this
saying
episode.
People over 50 can't make cool transgressive things. I just figure maybe they already made those things, and this was like the next thing at the bottom of the pile. That they
how many people in the writers' room were women?
Yeah,
same kind of question.
Yeah, I'd have to have a question. I'll say there's one great episode of the show. I mean, I'll call this one out. There are others that were, I think. Season one, I got to episode five and gave up. And then I was like, I was bored. It was pandemic. I started watching it again. I was like, oh, this is a little better than I thought. Went back and watched the whole first season. I was like, oh, actually, this is a little better. And then season two was actually much more even. And then it just kind of, I felt like it lost, you know, it was exactly that. I kept walking away from it, not excited to watch the next thing. But
I will say,
great
one
episode
nice for it.
Wait. One, let me get one. Here's all the right. Great episode. The all bear right. Sulky episode was amazing. The King Zog falls in love with a woman who he sees take off a bear fur, and he takes her bear fur, right, like a sulky, and he wants to marry her, and she comes in the castle and she's very unhappy, and eventually she kind of says, I'm not a woman who puts on a bear fur, I am a bear who takes it off sometimes and is a woman. And it was actually a very sweet and poignant episode that I thought was really clever. And I was like, oh, a bear sulky. I've never thought about that. I mean, I know there's lots of like Skinwalker and other kinds of mythos and cultures around the world, but I it was a self-contained episode that was actually sort of lovely.
Well, here's the Netflix self-competition conundrum is they financed all of this great content, and it's wonderful that loads and loads of animation has come out of the very deep pockets that apparently Netflix is not planning on opening up as much for bigger high profile stuff, but hopefully will still stay open to some extent for animation, even if it ends up getting canceled and has to move to Adult Swim, whatever, as long as it gets out in the world. When you find yourself on Netflix disenchanted by Disenchanted, you can very easily hop over to Legend of Vox Machina if you want something that's explicitly adult leaning. You can watch Arcane if you want to be cool to the 13-year-olds in your life.
And I do.
And one of the things that would not have existed without that Netflix budget and interest in playing in different worlds is the animated Castlevania, which had originally, I think it was 15 years ago, they tried to get that off the ground. It died. The same producer still had it. At some point was in a room with Netflix and they said, what do you have? And he said, oh, well, I've got an animated Castlevania based on the third Castlevania game. And then the 42-year-old men making decisions went, you have a what? and you want to make it super violent and you want to, you know, put all kinds of adult language in it. Great. Sounds good. And I want to tie this back to, again, like the people who are making the decisions are following the lead of the audiences and where they're going. And I mentioned Batman the Animated Series earlier. There was this weird inflection point there in the early 90s where with Batman the Animated Series, which begat Justice League and Superman the Animated Series, there was a superhero cartoons aren't necessarily just for kids sort of thing that jumping to the other side of the big two comic book coin the X-Men animated series premiered in prime time. And they really hadn't done something like that before. And I've got to think that some of the Nielsen data that came out of that, back when Nielsen data really did rule all, is something that in some way created a little bit of runway for Western animation to look at, you know what, we can make stuff that plays in the middle ground area, but we can also make stuff that focuses on an explicitly older audience, which Batman the Animated Series, I'd argue kids can still watch it. And it was something that aired right after school, and that's part of what made it so popular. But that it played with an explicitly darker tone across the board is something that I feel like, if anything, people rant and rave about comic book movies these days ruining cinema. If you want to blame something for the rise in adult animation that thinks that fart jokes are just the height of comedy, I think in a lot of ways those mid-90s superhero cartoons that took their source material more seriously are what led to the stuff that in some cases, as we've been saying, takes the material more seriously. And in some ways, is just, a reason that, that this or that is getting revived as an adult leaning thing. That wasn't a thing, because in a lot of ways in the 80s and 90s, that stuff was being born, and now that stuff is middle-aged and looking for another job.
All right, before we run the credits at a speed so fast that even freeze framing it on our VCR won't let us read the names of the animators and voice actors, we've reached that point in the show where it's not exactly bring out your dead, because this is not a draft, but I'd like to make sure, let's do a little go round here, we're going to start with John McCoy, about shows that you wanted to mention in this episode, haven't come up in organically so far. Let's just talk about a few things. We can do a few rounds of this if folks like. What's something
I'm surprised that Love, Death, and Rockets. Love, Death, and Robots. Yes, it didn't come up in the conversation. That seemed like this crowd. That's a very. I have to say, one thing I like about that show is that they do a different style for every single thing. So, and everything is, you know, because everything's going to get thrown out at the end. They just, you know, go all out with it. Overall, the series is a little too dour to me. It reminds me of like reading heavy metal in the mid 70s, where every story was three pages long, and then the guy died at the end because the cartoonist got bored. I get the feeling that like everyone has to die at the end of one of these things because the people working it get bored.
Yeah,
I think you reverse engineered their pitch. Hey, you want an animated show that's like reading heavy metal in the 70s?
For folks unfamiliar with it, it's specifically an anthology series, and it is kind of enjoyable as a streaming thing, where episodes are between like 9 and 20 minutes, and there is very little any kind of connective tissue except that each thing is about love, death, and or robots.
David, do you have some dead you'd like to bring out? Speaking of death,
you know, not really. I'm trying to think.
Certainly there's a show that came out in 1982 that ran for half an episode and it was pulled while it was being aired. They ripped the cord out of the wall and you're the only one who sees it.
In 1964, James Garner wanted to...
Maverick.
Maverick was amazing.
Once we've talked about Fish Police, you know, David leaves it all in the closet. Yes.
you brought that out. You brought your dad up pretty early.
David's already mentioned about six things that I questioned whether they really existed.
although we had the moment, we were trying to find something on Netflix last night, and we really had the moment where we're pushing right, and we're like, they are making these shows up. These are being generated while we're doing right, because this is, we're just laughing and laughing. So I'm not surprised I haven't seen a new Fish Police.
The only things I can think of are things that, you know, they could be all ages. I mean, Bob's Burgers. I love Bob's Burgers.
That's a classic, right? Because it has a sensibility, but you could, yeah.
Yeah, it's just got this daffy sensibility all its own. It's kind of slant-wise from Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist.
I like that,
which
show
was aimed at adults.
Yeah.
It's you know, right in line. It's the same people did that. The same people did Home Movies on UPN.
Ah, you took mine. Which, bring out your dad.
Oh, no.
And then another show, you know, we've brought up Adventure Time and Steven Universe, and this is another Cartoon Network show that I'm not entirely sure who it was aimed at, but new episodes premiered at night. It's regular show, which
has
its own weird sensibility. If you get on its wavelength, it's delightful. It's kind of stonery at times, but you know, it's fun. And it's from people who did Chowder, which was aimed at kids, but again, you know, it came from that tradition of, yeah, it's for kids, but there are jokes for the adults that the kids aren't gonna get. So Chowder was, I mean, I loved watching that when the boys were little. Chowder.
Chowder. Tony Sindelar, you're from Chowder Town. We're going to move on to you. You have some dead you'd like to
I got three out? Dead I okay. will mention here. First off, I'll mention Primal, which is on HBO. From, I'm never sure if I'm going to say his name.
Jendy Tartakovsky.
Oh, yeah, I love
you
him.
Might know from Samurai Jack and other many things, who just does amazing work. The premise of Primal is a caveman and a dinosaur team up and go on adventures. It's one of those shows that has no dialogue and just looks amazing and feels kind of like a love letter to some 90s, early 2000s animation. It's great. It's on HBO Max if you want to watch it. Moises mentioned Arcane, which is on Netflix. And I will say that was a show that I just like, well, I'll try this. I watch a lot of animation and I was really kind of blown away by it. It's based on a video game that I have not played. And I was like, oh, well, I'm not really going to get it, but I'll try it. Knowledge of the video game is not in any way important as far as I can tell. It's this steampunk adventure story with a bunch of characters in a complicated city, and it's beautifully looking and interesting. And then the last one I'll mention really briefly, Poorly Drawn Lines is on FX.
And
I believe is based on a webcomic.
Yes,
and
I love
something
the
about that. There's not a universal webcomic sensibility, but there are some themes among webcomics that maybe that's where the new kind of experimental stuff is happening in webcomics. So the idea that people are taking webcomics and turning some of those into animation. Poorly Drawn Lines on FX. I believe I watched it all on Hulu. Was enjoyable and interesting as well. Okay. Those are my three dead.
Also, Leeson Schmeiser, Home Movies was sniped from you, but it's not a draft, so you also win. Did you have some more dead to discuss?
I would like to bring up Robot Chicken.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is definitely an adult. Definitely adult animation right there. Bringing back the disturbing claymation of our youth. And I feel like it kicked down the door that Family Guy kind of opened with its cross-referential stuff and pop culture, and has remixed it and done some really, really funny stuff. I'm especially a big fan of the way they choose to interpret Emperor Palpatine on that show.
Family Guy had to fart so that Robot Chicken could fart
don't
gracefully.
Finish. Could astronaut diaper it. The other one I'd like to bring up is one of those shows that hits in a liminal space, but there's stuff that even when kids watch it, they know the stuff is not for kids and they're motivated to seek out and do stuff. And that's Gravity Falls.
Oh yes.
Which is another basic coming of age type thing where you've got a pair of twins, beautifully voiced by Jason Ritter and Christian Schaal, who honestly is like an animation MVP. Because if you listen to how different her voice work is between Gravity Falls and Bob's Burgers, it's astonishing. Same voice, completely different characterization. Anyway, Gravity Falls, the twins, Mabel and Dipper, are sent to live with a great uncle in his tourist trap in the middle of the Oregon woods for the summer. Somehow end up falling into an interdimensional invasion / incursion. There's a really great episode with unicorns. There's stuff in there, and there's like lots of cryptography and ciphers that you're encouraged to solve. And again, it's mostly for tweens, but there are enough things in that show that are aimed at adults where it's the She-Ra genre. You're like, oh, this really hits kids in these five specific years, and adults can also enjoy it. And I just, it's a perfect summer watch. If you haven't seen Gravity Falls, like, you could watch it this summer and you're like, oh, it's like going on summer vacation. I highly recommend it.
I want to give somebody else the last word. So Moises, I'm going to do mine first and then I'm a host. I'd like the host to not be the last person. I want to mention very briefly, because I got a you know, shoehorn in a bunch of mine. One is, you know, we mentioned Venture Brothers in passing a few times, and I'll highlight it slightly more just as part of my Bring Out Your Dead, because I think, and David, you and I talked about this at one point. I think I hit season 4 on it and like went, all right, I'm out. This is too much. I lost the thread, whatever. And then at some point, again, pandemic, went back and was like, all right, I'm going to get through. There's some awkward episodes. I don't like where this is going. And then it was like, oh, this isn't so bad. And then it's like, oh my God. And the last season, it bloomed into their seasons were very far apart. They had production and writing issues, you know, and funding and whatever. The last season, I feel like, is so full of heart and meaning that it is shocking to me it could exist. It is, I think, beautiful in places and meaningful. And I was excited to hear there is a Venture Brothers movie that will come out sometime in the next 15 years, I'm sure. But it's yeah. It's underway. No offense to them. They're going to... But so Venture Brothers,
deadlines are not their preferred way of existing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first episode of Venture Brothers, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the Venture Brothers kind of comes out of the animated version of The Tick, which was a Saturday morning show on Fox. But it, again, like the what is it? The Little Wooden Boy episode.
Oh my God.
Absolutely impenetrable to kids.
Oh my God. It's just.
Right? I remember watching it when it aired and going, there is not a child watching Fox that is going to understand a thing that's going on in this episode.
I think it's important to note, and we have talked about The Tick in the past, that The Tick is in each of its three visual incarnations, moving incarnations, it is so incomprehensible and inaccessible that it's one of my favorite things, even when it's not very good.
Oh,
it's great. I'm
hoping it makes a comeback in animated form
that
allows Ben Edlund to just do everything.
The planets will align again.
Yeah,
I remember Ben Edlund wasn't the joke, and Moises or David, I'm sure, or maybe Tony, maybe Lisa, John, there was a bit that he said when he was negotiating for the animated version, he reserved the right at his lawyer's suggestion, like always keep something back, and he kept the live action rights back. That was the story, and I don't know if it's true, but it probably is. The other one is Undone, which is rotoscoped, so it's animated, but it's got Bob Odenkirk in a secondary role, maybe primary role, I would define it. And it's the lead character has to wear a cochlear implant, so there's some issues they deal with about being hearing impaired. She works in a child care center, and it's uneven, but it's a very interesting exploration in the way they use rotoscoping alongside animation to bring in magical realism. I think it's sort of clever. And another season is coming, apparently, after a long delay. They announced one is coming at some point. So that's my dead. Moises, what do you got left on your list, if anything?
Well, while it's on my mind, you just made me think of the rotoscoping pseudo-trend that Richard Linklater pushed forward with Waking Life, and then his adaptation of A Scanner Darkly. And then most recently, Apollo 10 and a Half, also on Netflix, which is a movie that it's perfectly fine for a kid to watch, but it's so explicitly about being a kid in the 60s and 70s in Houston, that it is kid appropriate, but I think really made for adults who are over 45, at this point. And it's a fascinating slice of that time in life, that has some fantastical elements that's really lovely that I'd recommend people watch. It very recently hit Netflix. Something that's on this long list of stuff that we haven't mentioned that was the product of somebody leaving SNL, or he might have still been on SNL, but the ABC network went, we need primetime animation. We need something that stinks. And that's The Critic.
Oh, yes. I still quote The Critic all the time.
The most uneven show ever made, I think, right? I mean,
there are more uneven shows, but it is wildly uneven.
I watched it.
It is from that weird period where, there was money floating around. And if you had a pitch that was, the Larry Sanders show, but an animated show, it would have gotten financed by somebody, because there was change rattling around in those couch cushions. Much more recent thing that got a new life along with various other things at HBO Max, that wasn't explicitly for adults, but, falls into a kind of She-Ra range of, middle readers could watch it, but there was a healthy adult fan base for it, was Infinity Train, which is this each season of it is its own sort of self-contained book where you're following a main character or main characters. And each of the seasons, the three seasons that they actually made, or maybe four, I lose track, but it got canceled before its time. But there's a lot of satisfying storytelling in there that has light serialization where you will occasionally see a character that you last saw in one episode of season one on this train that goes on into infinity. It is made of infinity cars, and each car is its own little world within different worlds. And there's a glowing number on your wrist, and what that means and what you do with that. It changes from person to person. I want to say four seasons they got. It's very much worth watching. It's on HBO Max. And I kind of want to, since I had it unexpectedly foisted on me, this wrap up job, pull another thing from the magical Sindelar document right toward the end, which is Bob's Burgers, as do many of these other sitcom style shows, whether explicitly for adults or, you know, for a range of viewers, do owe something to the Flintstones. And here's how I would argue that the Flintstones was very much animation aimed at adults that kids could also watch, because in its early black and white days, the Flintstones sold Parliament cigarettes, kids. And
those
you don't
are
make
amazing.
You don't make something with oh cigarette ads that isn't specifically, hey, it's the Honeymooners, but we just animated it and set it in caveman times. In the early days of everybody owning a TV, everybody had to be able to watch it, and they were most concerned with the adults that are actually spending money. So their top priority was, we need to create a product that the adults are going to keep watching, and that we can then make the animated characters sell cigarettes that the adults will then buy.
Oh my God. Well, before we wrap up, I just want to tell listeners that they can find more stuff like this on theincomparable.com. Yes, the Find Incomparable Network has thousands of hours of programming, and we just wrapped up not too long ago our membership. We love our members month, and it was both the membership drive, but we also produced dozens of pieces of content for our First Class Lounge. That's a special member feed that gives you extras. And so we did, for instance, David premiered a new episode of Galaxy Scouts Green. We did a lot of commentaries. One of them was a Real Genius commentary that Jason Snell led with Moises. I was on that as well. Steve Lutz, Annette Wierstra, and David
John
J. Lohr.
John Syracuse was not available
John
to ruin
Syracuse
it.
Was not available there. David Stade Lohr was also present. There, and David and I were both on the Threshold commentary, if I recall right. I kind of try to suppress that. John McCoy and I did on Sophomore Lit. We did the Da Vinci Code. So if you want to find more stuff like that, why am I advertising that as a promotional thing? Go to theincomparable.com. You can become a member, get access to bootlegs, which are episodes that appear like this one just after recorded with all the good stuff we talk about before and afterwards, that you can hear at once. I'm not doing a great promotional job, so it's left to me to thank Moises, David, John, Lisa, and Tony for being here. And thank you all for listening to this grown-up episode. I hope you'll turn your PG-13 rating off on your podcast player, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.